I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Baltimore faces big questions in the wake of the destruction and unrest related to the death of Freddie Gray. With all the focus on the West Side, where Gray grew up, and where riots broke out a week ago, what would it take to finally bring jobs and a higher quality of life to places like Sandtown Winchester or the other low-income neighborhoods in that sprawling part of the city? We'll talk about that in today's second hour. Up front, a national expert on racial profiling, whose ideas have been embraced by Baltimore Police Commissioner Anthony Batts, joins us, along with Maryland Senator Ben Cardin, who's introduced a bill that expands the prohibitions on racial profiling. Continuing coverage and conversation on Midday after the news. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here, continuing our coverage of the Freddie Gray case and its aftermath. On the show today, two big questions. One, with the disturbing images of last Monday's riots, fires, and looting still fresh in the national consciousness, how does the city come back? And specifically, how does City Hall and the business community address the social issues in West Baltimore that surfaced in the last 2 weeks? CVS has announced that it will reopen its damaged pharmacies. But far beyond that, what can the city do to finally address the chronic poverty and high unemployment of so many neighborhoods on its sprawling west side? We'll take on those questions in the second hour of today's show. In this hour, if the relationship between police and many of Baltimore's citizens is broken, what can be done to repair it? What kinds of reforms are needed? City Councilman Bill Henry will be joining me to talk about that in a few minutes, along with Lori Friedel, a criminologist who is expert in racial profiling and whose ideas for achieving fair and impartial policing have been embraced by Baltimore Police Commissioner Anthony Batts. Lori Friedel has already done some trainings here in Baltimore City. We'll hear about that during this hour of the show. But we start with Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland, who with Representative John Conyers of Michigan recently reintroduced their End Racial Profiling Act in both houses of Congress. Senator Cardin, welcome back to Midday.
Dan, it's always a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Tell us about the bill, and my first question is reintroduced. So this bill has been around before.
It has. We were close to getting it passed, I guess almost a decade ago, and then with circumstances surrounding terrorism that became more challenging to pass. It shouldn't have been, but it was. So now we think that the momentum is in our favor to try to get this at long last enacted. Profiling should have no place in proper law enforcement. Targeting a community solely because of its race or religion or national origin is against the values of America. It's counterproductive. It turns communities against working with police, which is critically important. And as we've seen in other parts of the country, it can be deadly.
There are already some prohibitions in place. So what does this do, Senator Cardin? How does it expand those prohibitions?
Well, this prohibits it at all levels of government, at the national, the state, the local, the auxiliary police, to make it clear that we won't tolerate this, allowing for private rights of action against profiling. It also provides support and technical assistance to police departments around the country so that they know best practices and can make sure that they are not using profiling as part of their police tactics.
You know, this brings us to this thorny intersection, the thorny intersection of the demand for public safety and the rights of citizens to be free of unreasonable, unlawful searches by government or just unreasonable or unnecessary confrontations with police. It is a thorny intersection.
Well, it is, but profiling is counterproductive. It really wastes valuable resources. So it is proper law enforcement will not use profiling. Let me make it clear. If you have specific information about a crime, identifiers, you can use that. That's not profiling. Profiling is when you specifically target a community for different types of attention solely because of their race or religion or national origin. Where we see African-American males that are stopped by police more frequently just because they're African-American males. That's wrong, and that's got to end.
The Freddie Gray case and the rioting and the unrest we've seen in Baltimore, your native Baltimore, brings new urgency to this. What is the chance of passage now?
Well, we hope it's much better. It's one of the issues that we talked about in Washington as putting together a package to deal with the tragedies we've seen too frequently around the country. Part of it would provide for help in enacting this type of a law, plus other areas where we think we can restore the confidence of communities to work with law enforcement. And one of the real critical factors is that in order to have effective law enforcement, you have to have the confidence of the community. We've seen that is not true in many communities around the country, including Baltimore. It's not as strong as it needs to be. So this type of legislation would help us restore that type of community support and confidence that the police department is working with them, not against them.
And Senator Cardin, one last thing. Would there be sanctions for violating the act?
Yes. Those who've, there would be a right of private action, so those who are victimized would be able to bring actions against the law enforcement agencies that are practicing profiling. So, yes, there is private right of action.
Do you think Freddie Gray was a victim of racial profiling?
No, there's no indication he was a victim of racial profiling, but there is certainly a concern about the relationship between the community and the police department in Baltimore, and that there is a concern that race has played a role in policing in Baltimore where it should not have. And therefore, I think passing this type of law will help restore the type of confidence back between law enforcement and police.
Senator Cardin, thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Good talking to you.
Senator Ben Cardin, still the junior senator of Maryland, talking about his End Racial Profiling Act that he filed, reintroduced with Representative John Conyers of Michigan. Joining me now in Studio A here in Midday is City Councilman Bill Henry. Nice to have you on the show, Bill.
Nice to be here, Dan. Thank you.
In the midst of this mess last week, you were actually at a conference at Columbia University. I guess obviously it had been prearranged, a conference on this very thing, right?
Yeah, I'm part of a group called Local Progress. It's a network of municipal officials from across the country, and one of the same organizations that put that network together, the Center for Popular Democracy, they had helped to organize this conference on local policing reform. I had been invited weeks ago. It seemed like a good idea to just pop up to New York for the day for that. And in the middle of everything that was happening over the last 2 weeks, while it was difficult to get on a train and only be connected to what was happening in town by phone, I didn't want to miss the opportunity to maybe come back with some additional tools for the toolkit.
What did you come back with? What did you learn there, you think?
So one of the things I learned was that, and I guess I shouldn't say I learned this, it was good to be shown this very graphically, was that we are not alone in this problem, that there are cities all over the country that have the same disconnection between their police departments and their communities that they serve and protect. And what I found was, as I'd found in a lot of other local progress workshops, was that some cities are making better progress than others in how they restore that connection. One of the things that came up in a breakout group was San Francisco, for example, which admittedly always gets held up as an example of things you can do when you have a lot of money.
Right.
But in San Francisco, they have a third more people than we have and a third fewer cops. They're making that work, and they don't have their populace screaming for more officers. They also have an independent civilian review board that's the investigative arm of their police commission, and that organization has in writing one new investigator is added for every 18 cops. So they are a very well-staffed, independent arm keeping a watchful eye on our brothers in blue.
Let me ask you about San Francisco then. I mean, I realize with that caveat, it's always held up as this, what you could do when you have a lot of money.
Right.
But did they ever go through a period of say, zero-tolerance policing as Baltimore City did over a 10-year period?
That did not come up. But we were in New York, which you know mm-hmm. is where we got zero-tolerance policing from. And I still maintain that while there are concerns about zero-tolerance policing in general, objectively, I think what we need to be careful of in Baltimore is that we did not even do zero-tolerance policing the way it was supposed to be done. In New York, when they stopped somebody who was jumping over a subway turnstile or, you know, was littering, and they checked to see if that person had a weapon on them or if they had an open warrant. But then if they didn't have one of those more serious offenses, they just wrote a citation and let them go. We arrested people for doing minor things, and I think that was a big part of what was the final fracture point between the police department and the community.
In fact, famously, at least 100,000 arrests in 1 year, 2005, and close to that or around that in a couple of other years during that period. So let me ask you this. Since Martin O'Malley was mayor and since that period of time, first Sheila Dixon and then Stephanie Rawlings Blake, the succeeding mayors, have said, we're going to pull away from that. We can't arrest our way out of these problems. We've alienated too many people in the community. And under Fred Bielfeld, that police commissioner, and then Anthony Batts, we've gone in a different direction. So do you think we've made genuine progress during that period?
I think we've made some progress, but at the heart of it, it's one. I think it was Chris Rock who said something along the lines of, if Ike stops beating Tina, did their relationship make progress? No, their relationship didn't make progress.
Right.
He stopped beating Tina. So we've pulled back from treating people in an awful way, and so now the awful occurrences are rarer and get more attention, and that's still great. What we have still failed to do is positive things to reduce the chances that those awful occurrences are going to happen in the first place.
People may wonder why I asked you that question, given the Freddie Gray case. His death from injuries sustained in police custody at a time when two succeeding mayors had broken away from that zero tolerance policing approach.
I'm just pointing that out.
I'm not saying everything's great. I'm just wondering if you, before Freddie Gray, had noted the progress, and I think you described it well.
There's a picture in the toolkit for building momentum from the ground up. Mm-hmm. It's a picture of a protester holding a sign, a young black man saying, "We are all one bullet away from being a hashtag." And that is a very powerful image because, for me, it calls attention to the fact that it's not that there has been a tremendous increase in actual bad interactions between the police and the public. It's just that now with the internet and with smartphones and greater visibility, more of those incidents are now not only coming to light, but being disseminated. And it's our greater awareness of a problem that's been existing at some level all along that is really resulting, hopefully, in change.
As always, we welcome phone calls on Midday, 410-662-8780. City Councilman Bill Henry with us here in this segment of the show. We'll take a call here from John with a comment about this. John, welcome to the show. Go right ahead, please.
Yeah, hi, how are you? I was just thinking that, you know, the issue with what's happening in Sandtown, it's not so much a racial issue, and I think as it is a class issue. And I think if you really don't address the underlying cause of the different classes that are created in Baltimore, you're really not going to get at the issue. When you bring money to the city, and you know you put hundreds of millions of dollars in the city, and then you just give these to big nonprofits or people that take the money, and you don't address education, you don't address work, you don't address home ownership, which are the things that transform people from one class to another, then all you're going to do is have the very same thing. And it just so happens that the people happen to be black. If you took all the same people in Sandtown or where Gray lives and you gave them a good education and you gave them good jobs and you gave them home ownership, you wouldn't have the same results. So then the last part of that is that the police are not involved there. No policeman is going to live in that area. You know, you can't get police to come out of that area. And then you have the people being arrested, getting criminal records. They can't get Pell Grants. They can't vote. So you create a permanent underclass. And just coming in with a job or just coming in with education and not listing all three I don't think you're going to really address the problem.
Thank you, John. I think John's right on there. And, you know, it makes me think of what you said at the city council last night, Bill, something you've said before. Do you mind just speaking to those points?
We
have to take a break. I was just wondering what you said last night at city council, I think, would be appropriate here.
So one of the messages that I've been trying to deliver during my time on the council has been that youth development, all of the things we do to take care of our kids, to offer them meaningful opportunities, a pathway to a brighter mainstream future, all of those things should not be thought of as priorities that are somehow at odds with or competing with public safety for resources, because that is public safety. Making sure that kids do not grow up to be threats is public safety. And it is, as an MBA, cheaper to deal with that at the front end than to spend as much as we do on the back end catching and incarcerating. The metaphor, I shouldn't say metaphor because it's just numbers. I started working for the city council in the fall of 1991 in the council president's office. Mary Pat was council president. I was her legislative aide. The first budget that I worked on, we spent something like $37 million on the Department of Recreation and Parks and $165 million on the police department. Over the last quarter of a century, almost, the city's entire budget has doubled. Costs have gone up. The police department's budget has almost tripled. And yet we are spending less today on rec and parks than we spent back in the early 90s. Over the years, whenever we have had challenges to revenue, when we have to close the budget gap somehow, police get held harmless or continue to go up, and rec centers, libraries, they take it on the chin. And then when times are good, police continue to expand because times are good, and the libraries and the rec centers may get additional money, but they never get caught up. And so we've continued to disinvest in the things that we can do for our kids and invest in catching them. And I want to stress this. I'm not blaming a mayor or the mayor. I'm not blaming a city council or the city council over the years. Elected officials respond to what they think people want. And I had a staff person for the mayor, not one who's currently working there, tell me a couple years ago when I was trying to make the case for more money for youth development in the budget, he said they had a survey from the University of Baltimore and recreation opportunities did not show up in the top set of city services that people expected the city to provide.
Did they ask?
Well,
makes me wonder whether they asked.
There's always a question.
Did you find it hard to believe?
There's always a question of how, but it's also a question of how you ask those questions.
Right.
Because if you say, is public safety important? People are going to say yes.
Sure.
But if you say, do I want to get my city safer by giving kids something to do that keeps them off the street? I think they say yes to that, too.
City Councilman Bill Henry, our guest in this hour of midday. If the relationship between police and many of Baltimore's citizens is broken, what can be done to repair it? What kinds of reforms are needed? Bill will stay with us for the hour. Lori Friedel will be joining us, Associate Professor of Criminology at the University of South Florida. She's on the show because she's founder of Fair and Impartial Policing, a training program that's been embraced by the police commissioner here in Baltimore City. We'll meet Lori Friedel when we get back. We have been trying to police our way out of a situation that we cannot police our way out of. That's Bill Henry, our guest in this hour of the show, city councilman, last night at the city council, concluding his comments there. And people gave you some applause, according to the city paper's account of that.
Well, I mean, this is something that, you know, many of us have been talking about for a while. I did an Ignite talk a couple years back where I made the connection that everybody watches police procedurals, you know, Law and Order,
CSI,
CSI, Castle. when you're trying to solve a crime, you address three factors: means, motive, and opportunity. Who had the means? Who had the motive? Who had the opportunity to commit the crime? And so I made the connection that maybe that's what we should be looking at when we're talking about stopping crime. And government is not doing a great job of restricting means. We can't get any kind of meaningful gun control passed. And there's plenty of people saying that even if we were able to do gun control, you wouldn't be able to get rid of all the guns that currently exist. So if you take means off the table, we're still looking at motive and opportunity. The police department, which is the main organ of addressing public safety that the city spends its money on, they really only address opportunity. And the way we can address motive is through youth development. We have to spend resources on things that are going to make sure that the kids we're raising don't grow up wanting to commit crimes. Or in some cases, we want them to be caring, because right now they don't care.
Bill, we had PAL centers once upon a time. If we're talking about the relationship between police and many of Baltimore citizens being broken, do your ideas integrate with that?
So PAL centers, in some fashion, I really don't care what you call it. And
well, that brings police into positive contact with kids.
It does. I mean, I think we had PAL centers, frankly, because we happened to have a police commissioner at the time who was especially good at raising money from the private sector. And so the businesses would give him money because they trusted and believed in him, and he would spend that money on PAL centers.
You think they were effective?
I think anything that gets kids off the street and keeps them occupied would be effective. I think it's a trick to find the right police officers to be in them, because the police officers that you want being positive role models for kids and connecting to them, we haven't done a great job of making sure that those traits are spread throughout the force.
Bill Henry, city councilman, with us for the hour. Now joining us, Bill and everyone, Lori Friedel, an associate professor of criminology at the University of South Florida, and most importantly, founder of Fair and Impartial Policing, this training program which has been embraced by the police commissioner here in Baltimore City. Fair and Impartial Policing offers training to help officers recognize their conscious and unconscious biases and change the way they react so that bias does not influence their behavior. More than 200 Baltimore officers received training last year after the Baltimore Sun's published investigation revealing that the city had paid out millions of dollars in settlements for police brutality allegations. So, Lori Friedel, first of all, welcome to Midday. Thank you for making time for us.
Thank you for having me, Dan.
And look where we are today, Lori. We're in a different place than where you were when you started this training with the Baltimore Police Department. And the question is today, you know, repairing this relationship. We can talk about police officer training in a moment, but just looking at where we've been through the last couple of weeks here in Baltimore City, what would you say we should be looking at and thinking about here in terms of the community's relationship with police and vice versa?
Well, it's not just about repairing the relationship. It's also about better policing. But with regard to your question, repairing relationship, you know, police departments can't do their job, even their crime-fighting job, without having the trust and confidence of community members. They need people to call the police, serve as witnesses, provide information, and if the community does not trust the police, they're not going to provide that information, and crime will not be solved. So Commissioner Betts has undertaken a number of initiatives, as I understand it, to try to repair that relationship and then also to improve policing so that, in fact, the Baltimore Police Department is working with the community, partnering with the community, as indicated by the fact that he's brought my team in. He wants to make sure that they're addressing bias in policing. So he's definitely on the right track, but it's a long haul.
We had a caller earlier state that he believes this is a class issue, not so much racial profiling, but class profiling. He just called in with that a few minutes ago, and I wonder if you'd address that for a moment.
Yes, absolutely, because when we talk to police about biases, we don't just talk about their biases that might be attributed to race or ethnicity. There are biases based on gender, class, sexual orientation, religion, and so forth. So it's very much a part of our training. But then the other point, Dan, is that when we think of abusive policing, and that overlaps with bias policing, because abusive policing is inherently biased, and it's used against the non-powerful. Police who are abusive do not practice their abusive policing on the powerful, and class is one way to define who is powerful and who is not.
Here's another question. This is for Lori and Bill. Given what's happened here, this type of policing now is under great scrutiny. We have, obviously, citizens with cell phone cameras watching all the time, complaining, a lot of brutal language used toward the police in light of the Freddie Gray death here in Baltimore City. And it seems like it's so broken, Bill. I wonder, you know, for citizens to trust police again, citizens in those communities that feel like they've been getting all the heat, and then for police to say, I want to be a professional police officer, I want to work in Baltimore City. Some people say, well, forget it. You're not going to see big recruiting classes in the future, for the near future here in Baltimore. So on the first question of regarding police and recruitment of police in the future, what impact do you think this will have on that? Bill, we want to take that, and I'll ask Lori for her thoughts.
Yeah, actually, again, in the case of amazing timing, I had a panel discussion on the criminal justice system in Baltimore at my district-wide community meeting last night that had been scheduled for about a month and a half. We had Deputy Police Commissioner, Deputy State's Attorney, the head of the criminal docket for the Circuit Court, and the public defender for Baltimore City. And one of the things that the Deputy Commissioner pointed out was that recruitment continues to stay strong. I mean, people continue to sign up to become Baltimore City police officers. The question is just how long they stay. You know, other counties, other forces are constantly stealing our officers, and the harder the job is perceived to be by them, the easier it becomes for other places to steal them.
Did they speak specifically about the charges against the six officers that were announced on Friday?
No, we did the
because I wonder, that's what I'm wondering about. You know, what effect that would have, this whole episode has had on in other episodes.
I think the closest we came to that was a comment, and I thought it was very forthcoming from it was Deputy Commissioner Davis, who said, and I've heard the commissioner say similar things as well, that they know that they don't have a great relationship with the community at large, and they know that it's because the community feels like the police department doesn't respect them. And they are aware of how hard it makes their job, not just in terms of, you know, losing officers, but also in terms of actually doing the job, solving crimes. They don't get the cooperation from the community
that they need to,
that
solve,
they
crimes.
Need to solve crimes.
Lori Friedel, I'm curious about your reaction to that, because I would gather that when you do these trainings, you're around police officers who actually want to, or they're there because they have to be, or they're there because they want to get better at this.
When we walk into a training room anywhere in the country, we're usually facing an audience that's somewhere between defensive and hostile. And in large part, that's because of the way we've talked about the issue of racial profiling or bias policing in this country. We've treated a lot of well-meaning cops as if they're racists. You know, some of the training, you walk into the room and the trainer's basically saying, in so many words, stop being prejudiced, these are nice people. And you and I, Dan, would be offended if someone had that message for us. So they come into our training somewhere between defensive and hostile, but we start talking to them about science, how the human mind works. We make the point that biases aren't about police, they're about people in every profession, and they start to relax, and we end up getting rave reviews. Sometimes the comments are, this was a lot better than I expected, I didn't want to be here, but why didn't I get this training 20 years ago?
Lori Friedel, her program was partially funded by the Department of Justice's Office of Community-Oriented Policing Services, Fair and Impartial Policing, it's called, and she's consulted with dozens of law enforcement agencies, she and her associates there, around the country, California, Kansas, Rhode Island, Texas, Massachusetts, and you also did some work in Ferguson, is that right?
We've been, the COPS office has sent us to do some work in St. Louis County, which is the county that encompasses Ferguson.
You know, I wonder what we're going to see now after Freddie Gray. You're expecting to see more work, more demand for this. There's a lot of political pressure here to push for reforms in the way we police our neighborhoods?
Yes, Dan, our demand started to increase in 2013 and then really started to raise in early 2014. And now post-Ferguson, the demand is great. We're actually struggling to keep up with the amount of demand we have for our training.
We'll take a little break here. We'll come back and continue our discussion on Midday. 410-662-8780. We have some callers lined up. Please stay with us. We just need to take a short break. And also on the other side, Amy Dillard will be joining us again, law professor at the University of Baltimore, who's been on our show here during the last few weeks commenting on this. She served on the independent panel that examined the 2013 death of Tyrone West in police custody in Baltimore. So Amy Dillard joining our conversation, too. You can as well. Our Midday email address is midday@wypr.org. A short break. We'll come back and go right to the phone calls. And welcome back. Dan Rodericks here with City Councilman Bill Henry in the studio with us, and Lori Friedel, founder of Fair and Impartial Policing, a training program which has been used already to some extent here in Baltimore City. Are you coming back to town, Lori Friedel?
Yes, I am. I still want to do the command community training where the Commissioner Batts, his command staff as well as community leaders come together. It was actually scheduled for this week, but because of the events in Baltimore, we needed to postpone it.
Well, I would think that part of the, I guess for lack of a better word, the healing, I don't think that's a good word, the healing that needs to take place, the future, looking at the future, the citizens need to know that Lori Friedel is doing this kind of work in Baltimore City, Bill Henry.
So the healing that has to take place, I think right now, what I'm almost the most scared of is that we will somehow try to achieve healing that does not address any of the underlying factors that got us here. That let me be very clear about this. I think trainings for, you know, more training for police officers and command staff, I think that's a great thing. I think that it would be wonderful if more of the police department, the individual officers, had as part of their daily work to understand how they need to better connect to the community. However, what I am a little concerned about is I don't want to see that become one more thing that the police commissioner gets to come in and ask for more money in his budget to do, that
right.
That it would be something else on top of the amount of money that we already spend. But at the same time, I recognize the fact that he's not going to come in and purposefully ask for less money. He's not going to come in and say, I think you should take 5% of my budget away from me
and give it to Parks and
Rec. Use that $20 million to provide more community schools, more out-of-school time programs. We've got 5,000 slots of youth works jobs this summer and 8,000 applicants. The other 3,000 applicants who aren't going to get a slot right now are going to cost $4.5 million. It's 1% of the police department budget.
I just need to ask Bill this quick question. Where are you on residency for police officers?
Because
it comes up a lot here.
Residency for police officers, I'm in about the same place as getting a pony for my daughter, which is, yeah, that'd be nice, but it's not going to happen. It's there is a state law prohibiting subdivisions from requiring residential components for their workers, and they have told us that they did the state law because there is federal case law that they think we would be at odds with.
Thank you for that, Bill. We'll look into that further another day. We'll take a quick call here. Helen in Baltimore, thank you for holding. Go right ahead. Welcome to
Hi.
The show.
I saw on Larry Gilmore Nightly last night a very disturbing set of images. One was of some police dealing with people who are violating curfew. The policeman dealing with the white guy said, come on, guys, go home. We don't want to upset you. We go on home. And the one dealing with the black guy, they blew pepper spray in his face and pulled him down on the ground by his hair and arrested him. It was so disturbing. It was like, Have the police not understood what's been going on? Don't they get it? I was so upsetting.
Well, the way that was presented to you, I can understand, but just trying to look at it a little bit objectively, and I would say, well, the only image you saw of someone being pepper sprayed was a black man, and the only image you saw of people being treated, come on, guys, go home, were a group of white people. And I'm not saying, Helen, you're a bright person. I'm not saying you weren't being – I was suggesting maybe you were being manipulated by the two images that you saw in contrast. I don't know. This is a hard story to pin down generally. You have to be all places at all time to see all police behavior when it came to the curfew to really give a judgment of that, an assessment of it. I would just throw in that comment. I want to ask Amy Diller to join our conversation here with Laurie Friedel and Bill Henry. Amy, thanks again for being with us.
Happy to be here, Dan.
Amy Diller from the University of Baltimore, where she teaches law, and she served on the independent panel that looked into the 2013 death in police custody of Tyrone West. I said this before when Senator Cardin was on with us, the thorny intersection of the demand for public safety, make our streets safer, and the constitutional rights of citizens to be free of unreasonable search by the government or just unreasonable or unnecessary confrontations with the police. So that's a thorny place, according to the law, I think. Amy, what about you?
Well, it is. If we go back to the mid-1960s and before, we have a really clear definition of when police could constitutionally interact with citizens out on the street. I mean, they could do it if citizens consented, or they could do it if they had enough evidence to obtain a warrant to arrest that person. And then in the late 1960s, the court created sort of an intermediate place between arrest and walking away freely, and that was this detention in Terry versus Ohio. And there the court said that police officers can briefly detain citizens for investigatory purposes when they have reasonable, articulable suspicion that criminal activity is afoot. And that's the quote, and I use it because that's become shorthand for, or the Terry stop is sort of shorthand for that. And it's, police thinking that they see criminal activity that's going on, not quite having enough evidence to arrest someone, and so instead doing a detention, in most cases patting down the citizen. And it's pretty clear that's what happened to Freddie Gray in this case.
It's such a subjective thing then, is it not?
It is. It seems subjective. And the court has said that it's going to review the evidence through the eyes of a reasonable police officer with the training and experience that that officer has. The court has said time and again that, what might look like innocent behavior to me and you and other citizens might look like criminal activity afoot to a trained police officer. Of course, the example that, causes the most problem is you or I might walk through a high-crime neighborhood and see someone standing on the corner and just think someone's standing on the corner. A trained police officer might walk through and see that person standing on a corner and see the criminal activity of drug dealing afoot. Now, the court has said that the officers have to point to particular facts and circumstances to reach that conclusion. So you got to have something more than just standing on a corner in a high-crime neighborhood. But one of the troubling things that the court said in 2000 was that if someone is standing on a corner in a high-crime neighborhood and sees the police and runs away from them, that those factors can create a reasonable, articulable suspicion for officers to stop and detain and do a brief investigation.
That was cited by the police union here in Baltimore in the Freddie Gray case. Now, Laurie Friedel, I'll go back to you because what Amy Dillard is saying is very interesting. When you talk about going into trainings with fair and impartial policing, that program, and you come into a defensive or hostile environment with officers, they must cite all this. They say, this is very complicated. And according to Terry versus Ohio, we're in the right here. So you're trying to correct. We're in conflict or some in some way. Do you get that from officers?
What we focus on, Dan, is, the professor said the officer has to think that they see criminal activity. And what we know from the science of bias is that, in fact, people's biases may impact on how they interpret behaviors or other clues. So, for instance, the judge in one of the New York City stop and frisk cases wondered, in her opinion, whether officers differentially interpreted furtive movements depending on the demographics of the person. So it's all very relevant. And what we need officers to be aware of is, yes, you absolutely have the right to use reasonable suspicion to detain. Make sure that you're not letting your biases impact on your interpretation of behavior.
Amy Dillard, thank you very much for that bit of information today.
Happy to, Dan.
Yeah, no, great to have you on the show. Amy Dillard from the University of Baltimore Law School. An email from Elizabeth in Charles Village. You'll find this interesting, Bill and Laurie. This past Saturday, I attended a group meditation held on the hill behind Frederick Douglass High School. I would estimate a crowd of about 200 people, all meditating and focusing on peace. I met a woman who is a mental health professional working with the Baltimore City Police Department. Her roles include helping the police deal with stress and, no doubt, many other things. I asked her how many others were employed to fill a similar role, and her answer, it's just me. I've been there for about a year. So this means that officers and all other staff have next to no access to mental health services despite the stressful and traumatizing jobs that they sometimes have. I don't know if that's accurate based on that email, but Bill?
Well, actually, that email is making me feel a little guilty because one of the questions that we did not get to last night at my panel discussion on the criminal justice system was, what resources do exist inside the police department to help the police officers deal with the traumatic side of some of, not just what we've seen in the last 2 weeks, but the ongoing activities in the department? The thing that I really hope people remember and don't lose sight of is the police department is a huge organization, 3,000 people. There's a bell curve. The overwhelming bulk of the officers are good, decent folk, men and women who voluntarily put themselves in harm's way to protect and serve, just like it says on the letterhead. And we should be proud of them. But there's also
jerks. I want to ask you something first before you go on.
Just like in any organization.
How often do you get complaints about police officers from constituents versus you're on this, northeastern side of town?
Northeast, yeah.
Versus, say, Pete Welch or Ms. Middleton over in the west side. Have you ever compared notes with them about that?
I don't know that we've ever sat down and compared numbers. Anecdotally, it probably not. The complaints I get about the police, more of the complaints I get are, why aren't they here? You know, why aren't they clearing this corner? Why haven't they dealt with that open air drug dealing situation, as opposed to the complaints about bad behavior on their part? And that helps me, feel comfortable that I have the right image of an organization where most of the officers are just trying to run around chasing their 911 calls. And then some of them are jerks, and then a couple of them are actual criminals, and those are the ones that need to get caught and punished.
Laurie Friedel, a question for you before we go back to the phone lines here. How do you measure progress in this regard? How does a police department, everyone's into metrics, right? How would a city councilman, a mayor, anybody in any of those towns where you've done your consulting and training measure progress?
And that is such a good question, Dan. I'm a social scientist by trade, and I have been thinking about how we measure bias in policing for about 16 years, and it's very challenging. It's very easy for a social scientist to measure disparity, but disparity is a social science term, and what's very tough is parsing out how much of that disparity might be due to bias and how much is due to legitimate factors. So that's really challenging. So an alternative measure that's easier and goes back to your original questions is, what is the community feeling, thinking, and saying? How is the trust and confidence, and what are their perceptions? Because actual measures of bias policing are few.
Let's take another call. Todd in Baltimore with your comment. Go right ahead. Hi.
Oh, hi, Dan. This is Todd. Anyway, my comment is, I'm a white guy. I do maintenance for city homes. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're doing fine, Todd.
Okay. I've been beaten down by cops. My coworker, George, he was also arrested for no reason. His story is so crazy. He's in his 60s. What happened with him was,
Todd, why don't you tell us what happened to you?
Okay, what happened to me was I was, at that time in my life, I was a junkie. I was buying drugs on the street. The knockers came around. They just jumped out. The guy, I didn't have anything on me. I wasn't in possession of anything. I admit I was not doing something that, you know, I should have been doing. I was young. This was like 16 years ago. Cop punched me dead in the face. I'm laying on the ground. He goes, "Don't move, Chili Pepper." And then he just had a whole bunch of us lined up on the street, and he said, "Oh, y'all going to jail tonight." And, you know, went to jail, whatever. My charge was attempt to possess. It's still on my record. They said it will be expunged because I told this, my public defender that I was, the cop punched me. He goes, "Okay, well, we'll just remove it from your record, and we can just, that'll be all that comes of it."
Todd, I was going to ask that question. Did you ever complain? Did you ever file a complaint?
I, at that time, like I said, I was a junkie. The only thing I cared about was getting high.
Yeah, getting high.
My life.
Right. Yeah. Thank you, Todd. Yeah. Bill.
Actually, that's a great lead in. One of the things that is before us, one of the issues on the table is our civilian review board strong enough? Are there ways that we can strengthen it? As we examine that possibility, I'm reminded of a conversation I had with a community leader in my district who used to be on the Civilian Review Board as the Northern District representative. And one of the things that she was constantly trying to get out there message-wise is to actually report the problem, because you will have these cases where people will tell the media, people will tell their council person, people will complain to their neighbors about something bad that the police did to them, but they won't go over to the police department and take the form and fill it out and submit it. And one of the other things that came up during the Tyrone West investigation and the council's hearings on the matter was we would be given the names of individual officers who had been connected to multiple
settlements.
Multiple complaints. Yeah. And that was one of the things that troubled me a little bit, is that every one of those bad apples, every one of the, you know, whether they actually committed crimes or if they're just, like I said, jerks, they were teaching new young cops, because they get partnered up when they come out of the academy, and that's how you create this socialization of bad policing.
John from Shrewsbury, we're short of time, but you wanted to make sort of the point Bill's making here about good cops and bad cops.
Yeah, it's a good segue. if all the cops or the majority of the cops are good, they've got partners. Yeah. So you got a bunch of jerk cops, and they're not turned in. They're not discussed. And so it just continues and continues.
That's the thing he was just talking about. Yeah, maybe the thin blue line is very strong in terms of that. I'm using that thin blue line in a different way than it's usually used there, but maybe that's part of it, Laurie Friedel. Police officers don't report others.
Right, right. Now, there is a blue wall of science, but going back to the fact that there are mostly good cops, I also want to make the point that cops over time, the police profession has gotten so much better, and that includes more internal accountability, and that includes cops turning into other cops. So even though there is a blue wall, and the strength of it varies within departments, we're headed in the right direction. And the good cops want a good agency, and so they have an incentive to make sure that they're colleagues who are not doing the right thing are held to account.
Laurie Friedel, it'd be nice to meet you. If you're in Baltimore again doing your fair and impartial policing training, please come and visit us here at Midday.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you. Laurie Friedel, Associate Professor of Criminology at the University of South Florida and founder, as I say, of Fair and Impartial Policing. And Bill Henry, great to have you on the show. Thank you very much for your insights today.
Thank you. Always appreciate the opportunity.
Yep. Bill Henry, Baltimore City Council member. Well, another hour of Midday ahead here after we have lunch from Bagby Pizza Company, so please stay with us.